came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim king.
Does anybody need a Bible? Excuse me, go ahead.
Okay. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia, and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Asphanaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among these were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, "I'm afraid of my lord, the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and all the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these 4 young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus.
Okay, again, just using the methodology we've been using, what did you see while this was being read? How was the stage set?
Daniel was given a choice, and he chose the right way to health and happiness.
Okay. And probably it's a little stronger than given the choice. He kind of took the choice.
Yes.
Okay, what else?
Well, one thing that pops out at me is that all the people who are in power are extremely reasonable. I mean, that they get given an argument and they go, okay, that makes sense.
Okay, all right, guy hadn't seen that. He said, "Well, it's a little risky if I let you eat the veggies, but we'll try 10 days." Because, I mean, he's in charge of, so he's got responsibilities, but he's willing to negotiate. Okay. What thing is being there? I mean, there's some things maybe even not so subtly being set in place here.
Well, they were picking from the royal family and nobility young men, and they were going to educate them like they were educating them for some reason.
Right. Okay. One little remark here that's rather interesting and probably reflects accurately the fact of those who went into Babylonian captivity, although this story is only set back there. I don't think this story is in I don't believe Daniel's an historical person, so. But But the people that were carried off into exile were the intelligentsia of the society. In fact, that's one of the problems that when Ezra and Nehemiah go back, they have a lot of difficulty with the peasants who stayed there, moved into folks' houses. And then this, some of those who go back, how do we reincorporate the returned exiles in the land? But it is the royal, it's the upper crust who get carried off into, because you need somebody. The Babylonians took people who would contribute to their economy. And so that's one little subtlety here. These are not just country bumpkins here. These are significant folks. But there's another kind of subtlety that keeps the narrator just keeps dropping in. Notice how the situation is set right at the very beginning in verse 2. The Lord let King Jehoiakim of Judah fall into his power. And as well as some of the vessels of the house of God. Now here, this is what I love about stories. The vessels are going to be sitting there. And again, I'd like to think of this this isn't even quite the first act of the play. And so what's happening here is the stage, the curtain is opened, and you can see people placing objects on the stage that are going to be part of the drama later on. So over here someplace we've got the vessels from the temple sitting there. They're going to have some significance later on, but right now we just happen to be told they're there. And then you'll also notice that throughout this, like in verse 9, now God allowed Daniel to receive favor and compassion from the palace master. So reasonable as he might have been, still the hand of God, according to this author, is at work there. Verse 17, to these four young men, God gave knowledge and skill in every aspect of literature and wisdom. And this is going to be a constant theme in this play. When there are dreams to be interpreted and all of that, we always have a little speech about where we're going to get this understanding of things. So, and then the question, and this isn't a question answered in the text, why don't they eat the food of the king?
They were worried about it. I mean,
what's to worry about eating the king's food?
Would they get poisoned?
Give it to idols first?
Could be. Could be that it wasn't kosher. Could be that to eat the king's food is to be an obligation to the king.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Indebtedness.
So we don't know for sure because we're not told, but we're left there to kind of think about why we don't eat the food.
Well, it specifically says that you'd be defiled by eating the food.
But I think it's legitimate that there's one side of this because of the concern about doing things properly as Jewish people. There is that concern, but the defilement may also be more than ritual defilement. It may be this obligation to the king.
Did the vegetables come from the king?
Well, they could have, but the point is, it's not. There is a distinction between the royal food that comes from that table and another table, I think. But let's just let them be hints. We don't know for sure, but it's enough to ask us the question about why not eat, because the author doesn't tell us totally why not to eat the food. Okay, now let's. We've set the stage. The thing is, in one sense, what's been set up here is that these Jewish young men are going to play in the same arena, on the same level playing field as the Babylonians. And they're going to be engaged in the same things. You know, and the things have to do with wisdom and understanding. And the fact that, and with something with dreams and all of that, and so we're kind of set up about what are going to be the court contests that follow. And then, of course, we have this wonderful little thing that when the king has conversation with these, he's just astounded because they're 10 times wiser than the other folks in the place. And we know why. Because God has given them wisdom, you see. Okay, let's read the first 16 verses of chapter 2.
In the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed such dreams that his spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. So the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I have had such a dream that my spirit is troubled by the desire to understand it." The Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will reveal the interpretation." The king answered the Chaldeans, "This is a public decree. If you do not tell me both the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you do tell me the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation." They answered a second time, "Let the king first tell his servants the dream, then we can give its interpretation." The king answered, "I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see, I have firmly decreed, if you do not tell me the dream, there is but one verdict for you. You have agreed to speak lying and misleading words to me until things take a turn. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation. The Chaldeans answered the king, "There is no one on earth who can reveal what the king demands. In fact, no king, however great and powerful, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king is asking is too difficult, and no one can reveal it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with mortals." Because of this, the king flew into a violent rage and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. The decree was issued, and the wise men were about to be executed, and they looked for Daniel and his companions to execute them. Then Daniel responded with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the king's chief executioner, who had gone out to execute the wise men of Babylon. He asked Arioch, the royal official, "Why is the decree of the king so urgent?" Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. So Daniel went in and requested that the king give him time, and he would tell the king the interpretation.
Okay, what did you see and hear in this?
The powers don't seem reasonable anymore.
Now we're getting into real life.
Yeah. I'm just, in one sense, it shows how conditioned we are to read the Bible. I'm surprised nobody was giggling through this. Really. I mean, the king has a dream, see, and he calls, and notice one of the other things that the author and Daniel loves to do. He loves these long names of things, you know, all the enchanters and the sorcerers and the magicians and everybody. And the king calls him in and says, "Hey, I've been having sleepless nights over this dream, and I want an interpretation."
He wants another dream too.
Yeah, and see, there's the hooker. And notice how it says, so he says, "I have had such a dream that my spirit is troubled and by the desire to understand it." And then they say to him, "Well, tell us the dream, and then we can tell you the interpretation." "And no way," he said. "You got to tell me the dream and the interpretation together. It's a package deal." And they say, "Oh, come on, you got to be kidding." And then he says, "Well, you guys are just stalling for time. I know what you're up to." And then he called, you know, and then he sends out to have everybody executed. And so, and that includes Daniel and this whole guy. And they finally find Daniel, and he says, "You know, what's the king so excited about?" And when we broke in the story here, we ought to be kind of on the edge of our seats, because Daniel has sent word into the king to give him time, which the Chaldeans had asked for, right? And then Daniel will tell him the interpretation. So is the king going to grant it? How is this going to work itself out? So let's read now verses 17 through 30.
There's one other thing, too, that works great for narrative drama, because they're setting it up as this, never in the history before has anything like this happened.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And now enter Daniel. Oh, yeah. That's a big deal.
That's right, yeah. Absolutely. And we need to, Robert Alter, in his book, The Art of Biblical Narrative, says we've been taught to take the Bible so seriously we never catch the humor in it. And there, it's to be more playful than that, and then we will be taking it seriously. Okay, let's go ahead and one other thing, one other little theological thing that's thrown in here so that you get the point in verse 11. The thing that the king is asking is too difficult, and no one can reveal it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with mortals.
So one other thing is all the training, all this great training and great food and everything couldn't prepare anyone, for what the king wanted.
Good point. Okay. So how's he gonna, if that's true, I mean, all the preparation, everything, and nobody but the gods who don't dwell with human beings can answer this, how in the world is Daniel gonna do it? Okay, if someone would please read.
There was one thing that flew through my mind as we were reading through it, and I can't see now what made the thought come into my mind, but the thought was that maybe the king had heard or found out about some sort of a plot that the sorcerers were part of that were trying to get him, take control or control through their interpretations, and maybe this was his way of getting back at them. And I'm not sure what made that thought come into my mind as we read it, but
yeah, well, he does accuse them, at least in some point, about the fact that they are up to something. Mm-hmm. You have agreed to speak lying and misleading words to me until things take a turn.
So maybe that left me with the impression that there had been some backroom politics or scheme.
Well, and probably the implication is if they got what the dream was, they could agree on the interpretation and then they'd all hang together rather than separately. Mm-hmm. Use Ben Franklin's quote. Let's read verse 17 through 30.
Then Daniel went to his home and informed his companions, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions, with the rest of the wise men of Babylon, might not perish. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night, and Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel said, "Blessed is the name of God from age to age, for wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons, deposes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. To you, O God, and my ancestors, I give thanks and praise. For you have given me wisdom and power, and have now revealed to me what we asked of you. For you have revealed to us what the king ordered." Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon, and said to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will give the king the interpretation." Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said to him, "I have found among the exiles from Judah a man who can tell the king the interpretation." The king said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to tell me the dream that I have, that I have seen, and its interpretation?" Daniel answered the king, "No wise men, enchanters, magicians, or diviners can show to the king the mystery that the king is asking. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has disclosed to King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen at the end of the days. Your dream and the visions of your head as you lay in bed were these. To you, O King, as you lay in bed, came thoughts of what would be hereafter, and the revealer of mysteries disclosed to you what is to be. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me because of any wisdom that I have, more than any other living being. But in order that the interpretation may be known to the king, and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind.
Okay, well, again, just thinking, what images, what came through your mind as she was reading?
Well, Daniel is getting his wisdom from God,
right,
where they are not.
But first, Daniel praises the Lord, mm-hmm. blesses him. And
do you notice anything about what's being said in the when he kind of gets out his guitar and plays this sings this praise to God? What there's some very interesting things being said in all of this.
How about he deposes king?
Right. And again, just thinking about making and breaking kings, and we're not obviously this morning going to get through all the stories in Daniel, but we're going to see a king made, broken and made. What else in this story, or in this hymn, this song?
Well, God is the one who reveals all the deep and hidden things, and that can't be achieved through learning.
Right, and there's also this implication about God as creator, and that in terms of he changes times and seasons. There's a lot of things that are being said here about where Daniel is to get not only wisdom but integrity and courage. And then what other points that are scored in this text? See, again, I think this is one of those places, if you were the king, I mean, what do you want? I would think it's kind of like a lot of sermons I probably give, and my people are sitting out there thinking, would you just please get to the point? I mean, what I'm interested in is the interpretation of the dream, and you're standing here giving me all this stuff about how you're going to, where the source of the interpretation comes from. Because he goes over quite a bit more. I mean, he must have figured also the king was a slow learner. So we really make sure that we know the source of the interpretation of the dream and all of that, because he goes on at much more length than probably we would think necessary. And again, contrasting or calling the tension that's been created in verse 11 about where this is going to come from, and then in verse 28, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. Okay? So we've set up now this tension. Okay, let's, if someone would read, well, through the end of the chapter.
You were looking, O King, and lo, there was a great statue. The statue was huge, its brilliance extraordinary. It was standing before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of that statue was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. As you looked on, a stone was cut out, not by human hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were all broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O King, the King of Kings, to whom the God of Heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the might, and the glory, into whose hand he has given human beings wherever they live, the wild animals of the field and the birds of the air, and whom he has established as ruler over them all. You are the head of gold. After you shall arise another kingdom, inferior to yours, and yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over the whole earth. And there shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron. Just as iron crushes and smashes everything, it shall crush and shatter all these. As you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom. But some of the strength of iron mixed with the clay. As the toes of the feet were part iron and part clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. As you saw the iron mixed with clay, so will they mix with one another in marriage. But they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall this kingdom be left to another people. It shall crush all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. Just as you saw that a stone was cut from the mountain not by hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. The great God has informed the king what shall be hereafter. The dream is certain, and its interpretation trustworthy. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, worshipped Daniel, and commanded that a grain offering and incense be offered to him. The king said to Daniel, "Truly your God is God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery." Then the king promoted Daniel, gave him many great gifts, and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. Daniel made a request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel remained at the king's court.
Okay, any response to this?
It surprises me that the king, I think if God hadn't intervened in all this, from the past things that the king has said, the king would have been very angry and cut off everybody's head at that interpretation. Saying you're going to fall apart.
Yeah, the king's response is surprising, and we'll come back and talk about that in a little bit. Because either that or he has what I call the Hezekiah complex. Do you remember in Isaiah 39 when these emissaries from Babylon come to Hezekiah and he has never heard of Babylon, and so he shows them everything in his, everything. I mean, his treasury, his tanks, the whole nine yards, everything he's got. And after they leave, then Isaiah comes in and said, "Well, who are those guys and what did you show them?" "Oh," he said, "it came from some place I never heard of, Babylon. And I showed them everything." And Isaiah is just astounded. And he said, you know, the day's coming when they're utterly going to destroy this kingdom and carry all this stuff off. And you know what Hezekiah's response is? "Good, for there will be peace in my day." Mm-hmm. The Bible is so intrigued with that story, it's repeated in Kings verbatim and made slight reference to in Chronicles, the Hezekiah complex. So maybe Nebuchadnezzar had that as well. Well, I'm still the golden head, so we'll not worry about the future. I don't know, but his response is surprising. What else do you see or think about in this?
Well, it surely sets Daniel up to be right where he can be influential.
Yeah, Daniel's forever getting promoted. I mean, it's hard to imagine being promoted when you're already kind of the head of everything, but that's one of the patterns if we were to read the rest of these stories. When they come to the end of it, he just keeps getting promoted. So you wonder, did he ever get demoted? I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing, and these, again, a way that you can read these stories for their themes rather than for their logic.
The repetition of the Joseph story, too.
Absolutely. We were going to point that is, you see here, one of the motifs is this is very similar to Joseph.
So power gets subverted, kind of imperial power gets subverted by this, you know, by these mediators and representatives of another god who, right?
Yeah, in a sense, I think reading the Joseph story, that as they looked at the fiefdom that was Egypt, I mean, where the king owned everything, who put that system in place?
Joseph did.
Anyway, what else about this story? Is there any other kinds of things that...
Well, it kind of bothered me that he worshipped Daniel, and Daniel didn't seem to respond to that.
Oh, don't worship me. But Daniel did, I mean, did, of course... get him so, but you see, there's another little interesting thing that's going on here, and this is a pattern in the book of Daniel, is that these kings who essentially wouldn't know Yahweh if they ran over Yahweh with a truck worship him. And so part of what's anticipated in these stories is the theology that is represented by the interpretation of the dream, that this great rock that comes to crush this remaining kingdom and fills the whole earth, in like verse 44, in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, and nor shall this kingdom be left to another people. It shall crush all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. And this is the kind of the theology that informs all of this, is that one day God will fill everything. Now,
The other thing that I'm noticing, just in terms of what you said about Daniel not being a historical figure, but being sort of a role model, that what you have here is Daniel's being very forthright, very honest, and very articulate about what he believes. And if he does that, everything ends up being okay.
Yeah.
So it's this sort of, you know, if you're just upfront and honest and do what God tells you to do, everything will be fine in the end.
That's the model that's being set forth. Now, one of the problems with life is it's not that neat, right?
Mm-hmm. We haven't got to chapter 3.
But the interesting thing, chapter 3 finally comes out all right, but there is a little clue in chapter 3 that we understand that it may not always work this way, but that's not what's at issue. Integrity is, and in terms of integrity of faith.
Sure. One of the things I was wondering, I don't know whether, I seem to hear echoes in here also of Elijah and all the Canaanite prophets, the prophets of Baal, and the sort of showdown on Mount Carmel, and the sort of notion of Yahweh emerges triumphant in a place where all the other gods have claimed allegiance, and here's Israel now out of their own land, in this foreign land, and still Yahweh is, you know, the showdown between all these magicians who can't do anything, and then Daniel comes along, and one man, you know, reveals Yahweh.
Yeah, and again, you'll notice there are a lot of creation motifs in this, even at the beginning of this interpretation. In verse 37, "You, O King, the King of Kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the might, and the glory, and whose hand and is given human beings, whether they live in..." And this, so in one sense, the sovereignty of God, the God of Israel, is being claimed even away from the soil of Israel. So that the parallels are there, but it's now extended. Mm-hmm. All right, any other things that... What we're looking at, and just what I want to have us discover here, are the claims that are being made, and we will argue with whether those claims always make sense and always work out this way, but there are certain claims being made. And as I like to mention... the Bible is wise enough in itself to argue with what's wrong with this argument about the fact that if you just, in order to do well, you just should do good, you know, and that doesn't always work. But at this point, that's not what the sermon is trying to teach. It's trying to call people to some faithfulness. And we'll talk in a minute or two when we get toward the end of the time about why one can afford to be, if that's the right word, or can be encouraged to be courageous, to have a little play on words. Any other thing that anyone wants to see in this?
Well, just the rock. Cut out of the mountain, but not by human hands. And I have a study Bible, and it doesn't even address that. There's no comments down at the bottom of the text. And isn't that the same as the cornerstone that the builders rejected?
Well, I don't think in this text it is.
To the Torah, you know, the Moses God that was given by God.
Could be. It's hard to know, again, how these images work. The one thing I'm surprised that everybody isn't worried about is which one of these kingdoms is Russia. Yeah. Must be the one with the iron and the clay feet, because it just fell apart, right? When we get hung up into all that kind of stuff, we miss totally the point of all of this, I think. Which then gets picked up and is probably one of the reasons for the marriage of the apocalyptic material and these stories about Daniel, is that what we're moving toward is that time when the kingdoms of this world become the kingdom of our God. I mean, that's the confidence that propels all of this. I just want to skip a couple of things because of time, and then just invite you to go and to read this material, looking at some of these themes about how they get repeated and amplified upon. But to pick up Jennifer's question verse 17 of chapter 3, we meet this, because I think the author, the narrator themselves, at least wanted to acknowledge that they were aware that things may not always turn out as they did for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but nonetheless, you hang in there. So verse 17 and 18, "If our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of the blazing fire and out of your hand, O king, let him deliver us. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods, and we will not worship the golden statue that you have set up." So there you go. We're going to go into the furnace one way or the other. If deliverance comes, praise God. If deliverance doesn't come, praise God. Because we're going to keep our integrity. A couple of other just general comments about the stories that are some motifs, excuse me, that you might want to look at as you read in the book of Daniel. One of them is, I think, the just absolute parody that and having fun with how it is that people in power get caught up by their own rules. And so you have these laws of the Medes and Persians that once the king has decreed that when you hear the sound of the lyre and and all of the musical instruments, you're supposed to fall down and worship. And then he finds out, this is going to do in my favorite courtier, Daniel, but I can't change it. And I mean, just think about how that works in human history, and about how even, in our society, politicians get hung up in their ideology and they can't change. I mean, one of the great problems the Republican Party has now is, how does it keep its base, which will never get it elected? I think that's a play on all of this kind of, and the Democrats have their same problem also, but I think that there's a just kind of a laughing at that in this book. And you even perhaps by the artistic way in which the narrator puts this about, like when Nebuchadnezzar has to throw Daniel into the lion's den, I mean, he is in anguish. He doesn't sleep all night. And he rushes there just hoping against hope that Daniel's God can preserve him. And then there's also the fun motif that you see in Esther and a lot of things, that the enemies of Daniel who set all of this up for him, and Daniel's been in the lion's den all night and nothing has happened to him, and they throw in the Daniel's enemies, and before they hit the ground, they're devoured. So it wasn't because the lions weren't hungry. You got to understand that. But these stories, again, these stories are they're a certain genre that I think are a lot of fun. And if you read Belle and the Dragon and Judith and Susanna and Talbot, a whole lot of the apocryphal material, you'll find the same motifs told with nice variety and interest. Let me share with you a few things that I think will maybe be helpful as a way of setting or coming to a close with this. And this comes from one commentator. The literature is effective. It enhances the survival capabilities of those who read it and heed it. Judging by its reception and effect, as well as by the structure and theological content of the canonical literary expression, the Book of Daniel, we can challenge the notion that apocalypse was a failure of nerve, a theology that represented the fact that people thought all other options were exhausted. But instead, apocalyptic writing is anything but a failure of nerve, because it leads to this kind of courage to go on keeping on doing what one is called to do while we wait for God to bring the clear and certain end that is the end that God intends. The basis of affirming the validity and importance of the apocalyptic vision even for today is the call which rises from apocalyptic text from the very beginning. Do not settle for the status quo. Do not settle for the world that is being presented to us. Do not settle for the inevitability of what is said to be inevitable. We can hope for more than this. God will triumph. Because we believe this to be true and certain, we can live courageously now and move with courage into a better life. So Daniel represents an interim ethic. Given our strong conviction that God will vindicate himself before the whole world at the end of this age and at the inauguration of his new age, how shall we who trust him live our lives in the meantime? Live vigorously. Carry your trust into the very heartland of your oppressors. With God's help, beat them at their own games of wisdom and understanding. Contribute significantly to the safety of your people and glorify God in your faithfulness. And above all, remember that in order to say yes to this great challenge, you will have to say no to all the compromises that would blur your focus, co-opt you, and destroy a little bit of your true identity. Maintenance of sharp identity, uncompromised, unencumbered, and ramrod straight in the presence of oppressive powers of the world will prove to be a salient feature of the interim ethics, to be practiced by the saints before the great day of vindication comes, and the kingdoms of this world become the single kingdom in which integrity such as this prevails forever. I really like that summary of what this is about. And I believe that we in our society are called to this kind of integrity, this kind of as this author calls it, this sharp identity, and uncompromised, unencumbered, and ramrod straight. And we can carry that into the public arenas that we live without the necessity, I think, of being arrogant about it, but being confident with it. And if we had time, it would be fun to talk about, as we live out of the values that come from the faith in the public arena is there a way in which we can develop what one author calls overlapping consensus, rather than say, you know, let's take issues about faith in public life and instead of enforcing our point of view on someone, we can simply give reason as to why we think this makes sense for the common good. And one of the things about Daniel being in positions of power and authority, I mean, this author imagined him to be in the highest levels of government of the very folks who carried his people into exile. And he serves there. And he serves not only for the benefit of his own people, but for the benefit of the society. So I think there's a lot to think about in this model and in this example, and not get carried away with, you know, with all the speculation about, you know, what this statue was and what part of it was this king. You know, that's endlessly to miss the point, I think. Okay, we'll stop the tape at that point, and we can have continued discussion. Any other comments or Jennifer?
Can I ask a question? It seems to me that, and I'm not very familiar with this whole story, but it seems that Daniel sort of led Nebuchadnezzar to Nebuchadnezzar's downfall, because in 236, he goes on and on about how Nebuchadnezzar was chosen by God and how Nebuchadnezzar was put into power by God and how Nebuchadnezzar is favored by God. And it seems to me that if Daniel pumps Nebuchadnezzar up this much and says, you are the chosen one, it seems fairly inevitable that the king is going to get awfully full of himself and start to think of himself as a god.
Well, he may already been there, but I think the deeper or the narrator's point of view in that is that Nebuchadnezzar has his position, and this is a very interesting thing when you think about it theologically, the person who represents the nation that has carried us into captivity is God's agent. I mean, that's the boldness of this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Please call the Messiah, I mean Cyrus.
Yeah, I mean,
Isaiah's called the Messiah.
But, and it kind of goes along with the theologies you were talking about last night, where God is responsible for everything. You know, the good and the bad.
See,
and that's the whole Old Testament is certainly kind of geared on that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Did I read it?
Joel, do you want to respond?
Well, yeah. On the other hand, those in the Bible who know God best are not at all eager to be chosen by God, because they get used up.
Yeah. In response to the question, this is what I think is the core of biblical theology, and it's I believe that. That the core of biblical theology is that God is in control of everything. And then what do you do with the problem of evil? And I think the Bible does various things, if evil isn't an adequate word, why it is that things don't turn out right. I mean, whether that's good, evil, or whatever. And the Bible is willing to live with that, but it will not surrender that God is in charge of everything. Even, I think you can find passages in which it looks very much like God has caused this evil to fall on us, whether we deserved it or didn't deserve it. I believe that biblical faith says you are the potter and we are the clay, and if you shape us this way or that way, that's the way it is. Now, I don't want to live with biblical faith, so we're always looking for the alternatives, which the First Testament calls fertility religions. Fertility religions are the way that we make the world turn out right for us. Lutherans do that intellectually. If we can have meaning about why things happen, then we can live with it. Even if it, this will sound strange, even if it doesn't make sense. And other people have different ways of trying to squeeze away from, or you know, get out from under, I think, this overwhelming biblical sense. Because I think, and this is way oversimplified, especially for a philosopher, but if God isn't in charge of everything, then you must be in a situation in which you have a dualism that's absolute. Good and evil are equal forces, or maybe good is a little better force than evil, but I don't think the Bible will tolerate that philosophical option.
God is in charge of everything, yet Daniel, his attentiveness, you know, to that God is critical.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, that's the other part of this. What is obedience about then? I mean, responsibility. I mean, it doesn't lead to quietism or fatalism. You know, we talked about this in some other arenas here, but maybe it was even last night when I mentioned that when we go to Tanzania and meet the Christians there, I can't tell whether they're fatalists or just, have this incredible faith in God. I mean, it just baffles me. It's what God wills. And there's a certain attractiveness, but there also can lead to, that's what God wills, so I won't do anything about it. But for the Bible, that's, you know, this is what God wills, and I'm going to do something about it. I'm called to do something about it.
You know, I really struggle with this. You know, God's in charge of everything, because I don't like how it plays out then when horrible things happen to people who don't seem to deserve it. And I'm not sure that it says, I think biblically it's complicated. I mean, even with Abraham, it's through Abraham and Sarah's faithfulness that all of the nations will be blessed. So that God's will to bless the nations is mediated through people, through a chosen people, and their faithfulness. It matters to what extent we live out the will of God, so that it's contingent upon our obedience, that God's power is limited by human faithfulness to some extent.
Well, but when you look at the story of Abraham and Sarah, what's the first thing that Abraham does when he's got the promise?
When he's got the promise.
He goes down and passes Sarah off as his sister.
Oh yeah.
And so
Yeah, but that's the theme of deception, and the theme of deception shows up throughout Genesis. And it's deception as a virtue. Why pass your wife off as your sister? It's to survive. Why does
But it puts the promise at risk, does it not?
No, it makes the promise survive. It allows the promise to survive.
No, I mean, I think that's one way to read it, certainly. The other kind of thing about, and we could have a long discussion about this, because I see this same theme about not attending to the promise in David. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in 2 Samuel 7, when David gets this promise that God's going to build him a house, then the whole story of David is about the disarray in his house. Mm-hmm. Absalom kills Ammon, and then there's a whole story about all of that. And then when we get to chapter 1 in 1 Kings, and David is about to buy the farm, and we don't know who the next king is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know.
But there it's deception to cover up a sin. It's not deception to survive. You see what I'm saying? I mean, it's David covers up his affair with Bathsheba to the extent that he gets Uriah killed. God decides to punish David, and by doing to do so kills the fruit of their union, and that creates all sorts of problems. And afterwards, and David has to live with that. But that's the consequence of a deception in order to preserve yourself rather than to preserve the covenant.
But who preserves the covenant? God does.
Well,
God stayed, because Solomon is about the 10th born son, as I count them.
Yes.
But But Charlie, what about like with hunger and 35,000 children dying today? I mean, somehow, out of our reading of the Bible, we realize that God is a compassionate God and is crying because those children are dying today. So when you say God is in charge of everything, well then why doesn't he just fix it?
I think that's why we have a number of the Psalms who want to press the same question. And that's why I think when Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's Luther's sense about, you know, that he has a phrase someplace where if it weren't for Jesus, we'd have to give up on God. And if it weren't for Jesus, God would have to give up on us. I mean, that's...
But doesn't it take revelation, you know, some kind of outside revelation of this mystery to be able to interpret how God is in charge? And we can say God is in charge of everything, but that is not evident.
Yeah,
and it's not at all evident. That's Daniel. Daniel's whole thing is, I mean, he cries to God for mercy, and God reveals this mystery. Without that revelation, it's not at all evident that God's in charge of anything. Yeah. Looks like Nebuchadnezzar's in charge of everything. He's going to kill all the wise men, including Daniel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whereas in great times of joy and in times of great need, there's appeals to God. Where are you? Why are you present? It seems like the encounter, in order for God to participate in the story, even in the Old Testament, God comes this close to incarnation all the time. You know, the burning bush has a conversation with Moses. You know, it's like this idea has been stewing in God's brain all this time, that you have to talk to these people, and you have to come and debate and be kind of human with them in order to get the job done.
And that's when the one verse that really struck out, and I realize this may be a Christian reading the story, so it really stands out, but the verse 11 of chapter 2, where it says, the thing that the king is asking is too difficult, and no one can reveal it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with mortals. And of course, you know, incarnation is going to be just the reverse of that, the God whose dwelling in some sense does become with mortals, and that way that God keeps coming down and being present with mortals.
Yeah, and of course he gets present, or somebody gets present in the furnace. Mm-hmm. I mean, whatever that is.
Yeah. Is there any difference in your mind between saying God is in charge of everything and God is present and working in some mysterious way in the midst of everything?
I think that's how he's in charge of everything.
Because in charge of everything makes it sound like God is the one who's killing the first, you know, all the kids in Bethlehem, and God is the one who's, you know, sort of behind the scenes engineering everything, the bad.
See, you know, I kind of like to play this little role, obviously, because it makes us it makes us so uncomfortable. But it seems to me, and you can correct me about this, but it seems to me that is the number one premise in the First Testament, and on which I believe the Second Testament is also built, is that God is the creator, and that there is also this, and this is what I think is and I'm going to, tonight in the worship service, I'm going to try to address a little bit from the creation story. You have this group of exiles in Babylon who create a liturgy that has as its theme over and over again, and God saw that it was good. And their whole world is falling apart. And the last thing, when God sees everything that God has made, and he said, it is very good. What an affirmation. I mean, I think it's willing to live with the dark side as well as to live with, you know, that somehow it throws that affirmation in the face of all of this stuff that doesn't make sense, that it not only seems the wrong, it is. It's not right that 35 million children will die today. And, you know, one of the reasons we probably don't want to get into conversation with God about that is he may ask us, what are we doing about it? I mean, living with the wealth I have, what am I doing about 35,000 children dying today? So, I mean, that's why it's a little dangerous to get in these conversations with God, But I think it's, you know, I think it is the biblical faith to have that affirmation as defiance in the face of this world, and to hassle with God about it, and to celebrate those places where we see that faithfulness, and
well, isn't that, I guess, what John is saying, the trident protester? And somebody said to him, why are you always having a smile on your face? And he says, ultimately, I know how it's going to come out. Mm-hmm. But, I don't know, that's a hard place to live, I think.
It is, but... We probably ought to go into Daniel's prayer and ask for some revelation about this bad dream we're having. But, you know, and again, to ground this in the theology of the cross or whatever, I mean, one of the deep... The theology of the cross, I don't think, is given so much as a solution as it is a way of seeing. And, you know, for Mark, I think, especially, and for Matthew also, the fact that somehow the affirmation that God was doing God's greatest work in that event in which he seemed totally absent is the clue about how it is. I mean, it brings those two things, Bob, you were saying about how he could be in charge and in with and under all this stuff. And that's fairly paradoxical, if not contradictory, I think. But that's what we've staked our life on.
I don't think I like the word in charge.
Yeah, it's probably not the best word, but it's... but if it makes us, in one sense, makes us squirm about that, it's...
But it's interesting. Each semester when I teach religion, one, we read Elie Wiesel's book, Night, about his experiences in the concentration camps, and there's the... one scene where Yom Kippur is approaching and they're deciding whether or not to fast in the midst of the concentration camp. And they're talking about trying to understand why the Holocaust is happening to them. And it's sort of a parallel to Job and the book of Job and the different friends of Job coming and offering all these explanations about why they're suffering. So they, you know, they come out that they've sinned and they're being punished, or God is testing them, or all these different answers. But I always, you know, struck at Wiesel's answer at that point was that he doesn't doubt God's omnipotence, God's sovereignty, but he does doubt God's absolute justice. At that point, it's like, how to hold those two in tension. Can you have absolute justice at the cost of the 35,000 children a day? Even if that, do we have to have that in order to maintain God's omnipotence?
I appreciate Elie Wiesel simply for keeping those questions always alive. I mean, it's like if you've read his little piece on Job, you know, he says he likes Job up until the point that Job and God made this bargain at the end, because what about Job's first children? I mean, Job got a good deal out of it, more children and more wealth, you know, but what about those first children? Anyway. So, glad we settled all that.